Good afternoon, it's Monday, February 13th, 1:05 p.m., 1300 on the 13th. I better not wait till 2 tomorrow, I won't have time to do the walk. So, it's been a bit of a morning, actually. It's been a bit of a day. Monday's therapy day. Monday's when I go to my psychologist. It was an interesting conversation that centered largely around thinking, which is always fun, talking thinking with a psychologist. So I've been thinking a lot, but apparently it doesn't really show up much. I felt bad about missing the 2 days, but, you know, I said when I started, it was what it is. It is what it is. And if I walk, I walk. Some days, it isn't going to happen, I guess. It wasn't that I consciously said I'm not going to walk today. It was like the day really did literally get away from me and was over before I realized I hadn't done the walk. That's one of the reasons why I try to walk early, between 7 and 8 a.m. as a rule. But with it being in the single digits and dark between 7 and 8 a.m. and occasionally being tapped to take elder daughter to school, it's not a time frame I can rely on much. Perhaps when the cycle of the year gets around a little bit more and I have a more reliable time frame, I will be more reliable. So I've been thinking a lot about publishing and how technology, education, and culture interact, interrelate, and actually have a bearing on publishing. And one of the things that I ask my students to do, and I've done this for a long time now, is to blog. And most of them don't understand why, because they're just not invested. And the answer, of course, is that it's complicated. The first, it's not really complicated, it's really quite simple, but the root is that at the end of the course, Blackboard locks the doors. Anything the student puts in the course up until that point is lost to them forever unless they save a copy. Now, what's particularly significant to me is that what they lose is the connection to each other. Now, for most of them, they don't give a crap, which I find quite interesting and indicative of something larger. They don't really care that they're losing the connection with each other. They don't really care that they're losing the work that they put into the course because they don't really care about the course. The course is 3 credit hours toward a master's degree, which would give them a pay bump, which is really what they're interested in. So from a certain perspective, they're typical students. Because when you think of what we tell students about education, well, you need to go to school so you can get a credential, so that you can get a good job, so you can earn a good living, so you can be comfortable. And truth, you know, I'm not sure. I know that's a sort of a blasphemous, heretical concept for a baby boomer approaching 60, and I'm certainly comfortable, at least financially. And yes, I did get 3 degrees, finally, although I didn't actually get the first one until I was 40. So I didn't get education so that I could get a job. I got education and then found myself unemployed and unemployable for the most part because I didn't find a management position, and because I'd held one, I couldn't take a position that wasn't management because I was overqualified. So it's an interesting dilemma, this notion of technology, education, and culture. Why do we have education? And how does that relate to publication? Well, interestingly enough, one of the articles that came across my desk over the weekend was about academic publishing. In particular, there were several actually. One was about humanities and how the move to create open source journals and to create alternate assessments for humanities scholarship was being much ballyhooed and decried, sort of like it's writing, so people won't have to remember anything anymore, they'll just have to look it up. Yeah, not so much. That didn't actually happen. While it's true that you don't have to remember everything, because you can look a lot of stuff up, the reality is the integration is no more on the page now than it was in Socrates' time. The integration of skills, knowledge, and talent is one that probably needs to be addressed, but nobody really wants to talk about talent. They want to talk about skills, knowledge, and attitude. Because skills, knowledge, and to a certain extent attitude, can be trained. Talent, on the other hand, talent is a much more fickle beast. You can train a skill, but without the talent to exercise that skill in a way that is pertinent, it becomes just another exercise. It becomes something that came across my desk this morning. I was reading the blog booksandsuch.biz. It's an agent blog, and I don't really have a lot of truck with agents. I don't want one. I'm not interested in having one. But what's her name? I can't think of her first name now. Her last name is Gardner. Wrote an interesting post about what business are we in, which echoed something that I said in a convention not too long ago, like the end of last month, that publishers are in the book business, but writers and readers are in the story business. I'm going to try to cross the street to get away from this dog. So readers and writers operate in an environment where what they think they're doing is providing and consuming, for lack of a better term, stories. Booksellers, on the other hand, believe they're in the process of acquiring and selling books. And this is really obvious in the way that they approach pricing, in the way they approach marketing, in the way they talk about their models in terms of pricing paperback and timing release for paperback so that it doesn't cannibalize hard copy sales. As if a hardcover and a paperback are in fact competing goods. That if I buy a hardcover, I'm not going to buy a paperback. Or if I buy a paperback, I'm not going to buy a hard copy because I've got the paperback. The reality is, and I think this is pretty much lost on most people in media, they're not exchangeable goods, interchangeable goods. I'm not going to buy a hardcover because I don't buy hardcovers. I'm going to buy a paperback because I only buy paperbacks. I'm going to buy an ebook because I only buy ebooks. It has nothing to do with which one is available or which one I might buy instead or whether or not I'm going to shell out for the higher price spread. My choice to buy which one I buy has to do with a combination of factors. And in the ebook world, the not inconsiderable factor, the 800-pound gorilla in the room, is convenience. They're just so much easier to deal with. Yeah, I've got books on Nook, I've got books on Kindle, I've got books on Smashwords, I've got books everywhere. But it's still easier. When I need to move, all I have to do is throw the e-readers in a box and I'm done. I don't even need to do that. I could just get a new one when I get there. And all my books will still be there. At least for now. Will that change? I don't know. Possibly. But that's not any different than paperbacks, because I've moved enough in my life that the paperbacks that I had and cherished years ago have long since gone away. I'm no longer aware of where they might be or even which ones they might be. Wasp, Eric Russell's novel, was one that I just reacquired in ebook form. One of the few titles from my youth that I can remember because it was so important to me. There was another one. Something like The Five-Fingered Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, which I want to say is a Philip K. Dick story, but I'm not sure. Anyway, I'm probably remembering that title wrong, and I apologize for butchering it. Well, one of the things that came across this morning was this post on Book Business and Books and Such, or whatever it was, booksandsuch.biz. And it was about, what business are we in? And there were some good points made, and then three questions asked at the end. What business are we in? What do you think? What are the obstacles to change? And there's a third one. I spent so much time writing about it this morning, I think I'd remember, but I don't. At any rate, I wrote a wickedly long post. And scanning down through the comments later today and looking them over, and one of the sort of rhetorical questions that was asked in the body of the post was, as a reader, what would you pay for? What are you buying? And one post was very terse. Editing, period. Good grammar and proper, I think it was something like good grammar and proper punctuation. And I thought, you know, I know you're a good person and you really think that, but truthfully, I don't think that's what you buy. I think you buy the story. Yeah, if the editing is bad, if the proofreading is bad, if there's typos everywhere, if the grammar is terrible, then it's hard for you to get into the story. But it's really the story. And I don't care how good a proofreader it is. I don't care how good the punctuation is. I don't care how good the spelling is. The people buy a story. Because nobody ever bought a book because they said, every word in this story, every word in this book is spelled correctly. The author doesn't misuse one single comma in the whole manuscript. It's so impressive, I've bought copies to give to my friends. That's not what they do. That's not how people behave. And I don't think that's what people really think. I think it's a good story. I only buy good editing. Because it lets one feel, to a certain extent, superior. I don't buy that 99-cent dreck because it's just dreadful. When the reality is some of it is actually quite good. And some of it's pretty bad. Is some of the mainstream stuff, most of it has been at least passed through a proofreader a couple of times. Most of the errors are out of it. It doesn't make them all that much better in terms of story. In fact, I think it makes them worse because it makes them homogenous. One of the problems that I have is that this homogeneity of product is built into the system that publishers, mainstream, large press publishers over the years have trained agents what they want to buy, what they can sell, what they can move to a bookstore. And agents, as a result, know exactly, within some parameters, what they can move along and what they can't. So what an agent will pick up is what they anticipate that a buyer, that a publisher will buy. In turn, who is only buying that thing that sold well last month or last year or the last big success, because that's what they want, is another big success. And they really don't have any clue about how to get it, because if they did, they wouldn't have stinkers. And they do have stinkers all the time. Perfectly edited, wonderfully punctuated, grammatically correct stinkers. So, yeah, I don't think so. I don't think they're buying punctuation. I think, in spite of the protestations to the contrary, they're buying story. Warm. It's only in the mid-40s, but the sun is out bright. It's the heatest, the hottest part of the day. Clear blue overhead. There's a little bit of cloudiness over the mountains. It feels really spring-like. Oh, another thing that crossed my desk this morning. John Locke, the guy who sold 1 million books on Amazon in 1 year, and then wrote a book on how to sell 1 million books in a year on Amazon, which he sold for $4.95 and made a good amount on. He also has a deal with Simon & Schuster to do distribution of papers only. So paperback books, $4.99. In the bookstore, they're at Barnes & Noble right now, and as someone put it, right at the front of the store, one of those big fold-out dump displays where everybody can just walk past it. And I thought, yeah, that's exactly the problem. That's exactly why I think that this is a problem, because people on their way into the store will walk past it. They're not going to stop. I mean, I suppose some people do, but I don't. I don't know people who do. My family, when we go into the store as a group, none of us really stops, because we've all got places to go in the store that we want to be. We go to the genre racks. We go to the children's racks. We go to the calendar racks. We go to the rack where whatever it is we're there for lives. And I don't look at the books that are on sale. I don't look at the bestseller list. Unless I happen to know, for example, that Scott Sigler has a book that's on the bestsellers, and I want to look to see if I can spot it and take a picture of a book in the wild from an author that I know. And I had this conversation with a bunch of people on Facebook, on a group, and they all said, oh, well, yeah, it must be worthwhile, because publishers must think they're getting something out of it because they pay money for those things to happen. And I thought, well, yeah, maybe. But maybe what happens is not causal. Or what is causal is not the fact that the books are in the front of the store. If I had 3 books at the front of the store, I would, you know, probably not have the same impact as having 50 books at the front of the store. So it's not quite as eye-catching. I can see that. It also means that the first 5 people, if I only buy 5 copies, they'll buy the book out, and it's not available for sale anymore. So until the bookstore gets another shipment, they can't sell any. So maybe the causal function here is not the fact that the books are at the front of the store, but maybe the causal function for publishers selling more out of these display racks is that bookstores buy enough books to fill the rack, giving enough people a chance to have a shot at buying the book. Of course, the other side of that is that we don't know how many of those go back. I know when I was in the bookstore business, we didn't sell out of the books that were in the bestseller racks. We did not sell out of the books that showed up in the promotional bins. Those books went back because in promotional bins, we had 100% returns. And that's probably changed since 20 years ago, since I was in a bookstore, but still, there were special deals for bookstores to buy those. There was special money to be earned for putting them up. And there was very little downside to bringing those books into the store. And you have to wonder, publishers really know what they're doing? Because quite frankly, I haven't been impressed. Anyway, I'm back at the gate. Tomorrow is another day. I'll talk to you then.